Jack Gill is an entrepreneur who's thinking broadly and acting decisively to help create a decentralized energy system that makes appropriate use of biomass. In part one of a two-part interview, he and host John Udell discuss alternatives to fossil fuel for residential heating in New England, including wood, wood pellets, and a new approach that uses compressed tablets made from grass. From IT Conversations.
Hi, I'm John Udell. This is part one of a two-part interview with Jack Gill, an entrepreneur who's thinking broadly and acting decisively to help create a decentralized energy system that makes appropriate use of biomass. In part one, we discuss emerging options for residential heating in New England, including wood, wood pellets, and a new approach that uses densified tablets made from grass. There is an enormous amount of interest in New England, where I live all the time, and I guess you live some of the time, in various kinds of biomass heating, and in particular, we've seen tons and tons of bales of pellets appear outside of people's houses, and they've appeared outside of my house. And the pellet stove is from 5 years ago, or even 3 years ago, when hardly anyone had heard of it, is suddenly ubiquitous here.
Well, let's just say people wish it were ubiquitous.
Well, yeah, at this point.
They're backordered, something terrible.
Yes, difficult to get. And, the question of where the pellets are going to come from is starting to rear its head as well. So from that perspective, I was, as I said, visiting some folks and saw an article in which you were interviewed with this remarkable idea about making pellets in a more decentralized way and making them out of grass.
Mm-hmm.
On the face of it, right, the advantages would be, you should explain, but, I see a couple of things here. One of them being, maybe the primary one being, a much more decentralized way of producing the fuel, something that is analogous to the 10-acre woodlot that used to be the sustainable minimum for a family farm.
Well, that's a way to look at it, and as good a way into the rabbit hole as any other, probably. Very much like Alice in Wonderland. Once you go down the rabbit hole, you're in a different world. So I'm an antique New Englander, like the boring British people who discovered they're genetically related to the caveman they found next door. Been in New England for centuries. And been living in Vermont year-round for 3 years now. In a house that was built in 1787, it's practically impossible to heat because there's no insulation, fine construction. So the cost of heating it got my attention, as someone we all know and love says, big time.
Yeah.
And I started to wonder, well, what can I produce? I mean, I'm lucky enough to have plenty of wood, but the processing and handling of wood is quite a issue, and I have to do a lot of traveling. And the meaning of the phrase, keeping the home fires going, takes on a certain significance if you're relying on stick wood for your heat.
Yeah. How many gallons of oil were you burning, say, 5 years ago?
Well, 5 years ago, we weren't wintering over. In 1961, my grandparents bought the house because the person who was living in it couldn't afford to heat it.
Right.
And last year, I burned 7 tons of pellets and 800 gallons of oil, just to give you some idea of what a bear it is.
Wow.
And that only heated the large downstairs room to the mid-60s and the kitchen to 61 and the bathroom intermittently, and no heat in any of the other rooms at all.
Right.
So it was sort of caveman-like, which is, and my wife, of course, wasn't here. We wouldn't have been here.
Mm-hmm.
So it occurred to me that grass grows every year and you can harvest it, and clearly people burn it, and they used to burn it in the middle, Russian stoves in the Midwest in the late 19th century. They're clearly doing some work. If you start poking around, what are they doing in Europe? They're clearly looking at various sources of energy in a much more focused manner than we are in the United States.
Well, they've had the incentive for longer, so the prices of oil having been more, let's say, realistic in Northern Europe for some time now, it's the case that most of the devices that we Americans are importing to burn biomass are coming from Northern Europe, right? The wood gasification boilers, a lot of the pellet technology.
That's correct. The 2 years ago, you wouldn't have been calling me up. There wouldn't have been a newspaper article because, you know, fuel oil was quote unquote still affordable. We still had the illusion that fuel oil was too cheap to worry about. That started to change last year, and then this year, it changed very significantly. And I think next year and going forward is going to be more and more difficult to heat with oil or with fossil fuels in general.
Yeah, yeah.
But to get back to what we're going to do about this, of course, people have been heating with wood pellets in Europe and the United States for quite a few years now, and that's well established. If, however, you look at the total number of homes and the total amount of fuel oil being burned, you quickly realize that if everybody went to burning wood pellets, we'd have a denuded New England, a clear-cut New England once again. It would be back to where New England was in the late 19th century, which is 85% cleared land, only 15% forests.
Do we know that for sure? I mean, have these calculations actually been done in a reliable way? Because, you know, I've heard a lot of argumentation on both sides of that, but I'm not sure that I've seen convincing numbers and charts. Have you?
Well, if you go to the Billings Farm in Woodstock, Vermont, which is where the reforestation movement basically got started in the 1860s, you can find quite a lot of good information on this. The problem that provoked reforestation in the mid-19th century was so much of the land was denuded, and there were so many problems with runoff and loss of soil and loss of fertility and productivity, and the wood was being taken off faster than it would grow.
Right, right.
There are letters extant in Boston. There is a letter extant in Boston I've actually seen when I was working for Channel 2 in Boston. A gentleman was sitting in his wife's bedroom in front of the fire one evening in the middle of the winter. And the letter ends with a line that's pretty much, I have to stop now. I'm sitting in front of the fire, but the ink is freezing on the pen. And there was a fuel shortage of severe proportions in the mid-19th century in New England until the railroads opened up the Midwest and they could bring wood in from the Midwest, the forests out there. So we've been through this before.
And do you think that there is the possibility of a more sustainable kind of forestry than was previously practiced? Or do you think that no matter what, it's a resource that's too finite for the demand?
Well, that gets to the heart of the question. The best that I've been able to come up with for describing the problem is that we have too big a bucket with too many leaks, and we're putting the wrong stuff in it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So if we really want to do something long-term that's sustainable, that makes a real difference, we have got to start building houses that you can heat with 1 ton of biomass or 100 gallons of oil for 12 months, or what we call near zero net energy houses.
Yes. Well, yes, clearly that's what we want and that's what we need. That's multiple decade kind of transformation to turn over a housing stock. And
that's correct. But if we don't articulate the goal today, we won't get there at all.
Agreed.
So the goal would be to create strong incentives to build houses that require no furnace.
Yes.
Period. Now, they have, you know, 12-inch thick walls, triple glazed windows, solar panels, windmills, all those, you know, micro hydro, anything you can get your hands on. But, you know, those houses are being built today with today's materials, today's tools, and today's craftspeople.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I have friends who live in a house like what you just described, and, you know, they burn wood, but not a lot of it. And, you know, they're, you know, they have surplus heat, right? I mean, you like to go over to their place in the wintertime because they're practically opening the windows and
right.
You know, and they're not using a huge amount of biomass either. Right.
Right.
So obviously these things are all interconnected. And so we're going to have sustainable forestry, you know, we're going to have, ways of using stickwood, as you said, more efficiently, in wood gasification boilers. We're going to have pellets. We're going to have perhaps this alternate kind of pellet, this grass pellet that you're looking into. And, you know, those will be sources, and those are going to be needed very soon, right? And then I guess that the game is going to be to get them in place and then gradually taper off our demand for those things by tightening up the leaks, basically.
Right. So if we do everything we can today to reduce our thermal demand with conservation and efficiency,
yep,
then we look for, well, how are we going to now supply this reduced demand? And what's the bridging strategy from here to houses? Housing stock is basically near zero net energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think biomass will play a vital role, but it has to be looked at in a very broad sense of what biomass is. So we don't want to have all forests, and we don't want to have no forests. We'd like to have a mixed landscape. And the only way that we can have a mixed landscape, if we're going to heat with biomass, or a significant portion of homes with biomass, is to use all of the biofiber that we can get, that we can, in a balanced manner.
Mm-hmm.
So we use some wood fiber, we use some agricultural fiber, it could be grass, it could be any number of things, and we also make sure we capture all the cardboard and paper fiber we can.
Hmm.
Because we're really trying to accomplish as many goals as we can. Why, you know, a ton of cardboard down at the transfer station has about 115 gallons of fuel oil energy in it.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we putting 115 gallons of oil into the ground?
Yep.
Now, burning this stuff requires care and consideration. You know, wood we can burn in today's systems very handily. Grass, we're going to have to burn, so, you know, go back to something closer to coal technology because of the higher ash and mineral content. We burn cardboard and other things. We may want to be burning at 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit to make sure we reduce all the questionable things, the elements, so we have no pollution coming up the stack.
Yeah.
These are all doable things. It's just a matter of you know, sort of the chicken and the egg. Who's going to fund the development of the device? Why would I today, or why would I fund it if there's no demand? But if I don't have the device, how can I build the demand?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a tricky problem. But
you know, one of my observations here is that the technology to burn biomass cleanly is, you know, not necessarily all that difficult to develop. It's just that there never was an incentive to do it before.
Correct.
And you know, I mean, I love one of the quotes in this article. You're quoted as saying, a high school student in Morrisville has completed a successful prototype of a green wood chip combustion unit that can produce 50,000 BTUs of heat per hour. Gill said the student is confident the system could also burn dry grass tablets.
It has.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, but my, you know, when I showed that to my friends, my point was that, among other things, I feel that we've kind of lost confidence in this country about our ability to take control of some very basic things and to leverage what we used to call good old Yankee ingenuity.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. We have part of the article that you're referring to in the Caledonian Record was largely about biomass in a different form factor, which is what some people call pucks or tablets. And I think tablets, they look like tablets to me. They look like big, oversized alka-seltzer tablets to me. But one of the there's several points there. One, how do we get the fossil fuel out of alternative energy? You have to stop and think that if you conventionally, you look at the conventional wood pellet plant, it's bringing in raw materials from a very large radius, typically green wood chips or freshly cut logs, which are then reduced to chips, and then they have to dry them, which requires a significant amount of energy, and then mm-hmm. you have to run them through these energy-intensive pelletizing mills to get the product.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to make 100,000 tons because you have to dilute the costs of drying, so you know the raw material is so expensive, you have to dilute it across a large volume of product. then you have to truck 100,000 tons a significant radius to find the customers to burn it.
Yep.
And what we're seeing is as fuel prices become very high, trucking becomes a Achilles heel.
Yes, yes.
So the question that has been bedeviling me is, does it take a $14 million investment to produce a plant that will make 100,000 tons of pellets per year? Is that the only answer? Or is it possible to come up with a way of densifying biomass into a usable fuel that costs less than $200,000 and meets the requirements of structural integrity and relatively high energy content per pound?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you know, one earlier incarnation of that strategy is actually firewood production, which happens in a much more decentralized, much more local way.
And what kind of production?
Firewood, cordwood.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you know, in fact, it's interesting because a guy here locally in the last year made a very interesting transformation in how he runs his business. So, you know, he's a supplier of cordwood. And until a year and a half ago, he was paying two very high costs. One of them was the cost to dispose of all of the debris that results from his wood processing, right? So he debarks the trees, and so the sawdust and the bark. You know, this was useless waste product to him that he actually had to pay to have hauled away, right? Meanwhile, because part of his product line is kiln-dried firewood, he was burning oil to kiln dry the wood, right?
Right.
Well, so
very expensive.
Last year, he ordered the largest version of the alternate heating wood gun that's available, and mm-hmm. he installed it. And now he's dumping all of his debris into the hopper
mm-hmm.
And not paying to have it hauled away and
correct.
Running
yep.
his kiln on the heat that is produced by the wood gasification process.
Yep.
And so those two costs have gone away, and he is one happy camper, right? And so, you know, yeah, there's still a sort of a fuel component involved, you know, but he doesn't truck the stuff very far, right? He's only supplying, you know, a fairly small region here. So it's a, you know, it's a more decentralized model, and but it goes to the same point that you're making, right? Which is that, you know, any kind of massive industrial operation is going to have a degree of centralization, which is going to entail all of these transportation costs, as well as, you know, the sheer logistical difficulty of getting the plant built, right? So,
yes.
so talk to me about your notion of these smaller, cheaper, more decentralized grass tablet production facilities. What could that be?
Well, it's informed in part by the relocalization movement that has been developing for some years now around food, so community-supported agriculture. I don't know if you're a member of the CSA or not.
Sure. Oh, yeah. It's a big deal.
So take that model and say, you know, here's a farm family that's supporting 50 to 75 families for vegetables for 10 or 12 weeks out of the year.
Right.
And now they're starting to do raw milk, some of them, and some people are starting to, or at least they're connecting with a network of similar local community-supported activities like raw milk and organic meat, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, my CSA, I get my veggies once a week, but I get my organic meat once a month.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very convenient. In fact, I have to go pick mine up today. So could we use a similar model for energy? This question goes back, of course, to that material I developed in 1997 that I sent you concerning what would the home of the future look like.
Right. So for people who haven't, well, obviously no one who's listening will have read that, so I'll just summarize that you did some research and some writing a little over a decade ago on the concept of the zero energy house and on I think the word that you use is electranet. The term that I have often heard more recently is the energy web, right? The notion that the energy distribution and transmission system needs to become a smart network in ways analogous to the internet, in fact.
The term electranet is Al Gore's term.
Is it? Okay.
That describes, and he wrote an essay about this, and if you Google Al Gore electranet, you'll find an essay in Time or Newsweek, I can't remember.
Okay.
Well, this starts to get back to the more deeper meta issues about energy and society. I think we'll go there first and then get back to grass tablets second.
Sure.
You know, one of the problems we're facing is that our economics do not incorporate thermodynamics and do not require that end-to-end system efficiency be maximized as a goal.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first author that has been brought to my attention in this general area was in 1970, Georges Q. Rogin, a book on economics and thermodynamics of the economic process, I believe is the title of the book. And that led fairly closely on to the Club of Rome study, The Limits to Growth, in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rifkin wrote something in the 80s. Tom Wessel wrote a wonderful book called The Myth of Progress, which you may know, but I recommend highly.
Can you repeat the title?
The Myth of Progress.
By
Tom Wessel.
Yep.
Just a wonderful book. And if you start taking these precepts and you start saying, well, looking at our energy system, our current energy system has a number of common components. And the most common one is centralization.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at electricity, which is one of the backbones of our culture, and you realize that you start with a lump of coal in the ground at, say, 100, you get it to the power plant, maybe down to 90 because of the processing, mining, transportation energy required to get it there. And then because the power plant is a massive industrial facility, no one wants in their backyard. It's located out in the middle of nowhere. And part of the reality of making electricity is that you get one-third electricity and two-thirds thermal energy. And so you take that 90% of the coal, and you get, you know, one-third of that, about 30% is electricity, and about two-thirds of it gets chucked away in heating towers as waste, quote-unquote, heat. Now, in an energy-starved or energy-challenged environment, the idea of throwing away two-thirds of the inherent energy in a fuel is not a very attractive proposition. And the quandary is, if we insist on large industrial facilities, we're pretty much forced to do that because there's no way to use that heat.
Yep.
There's additional lossage in transmission. Of course, every inch of wire electron goes through, there's resistance. Every switch, every device, every transformer, whatever, there's loss. And I mean, thermodynamics does work, and there's nothing for free. And so by the time it gets to John Udell's meter, there is at best 20% of the energy that was in the coal in the ground reaching your meter, and most people think it's closer to 10%. So we're losing 90%, maybe 80%, at least 80%, probably 90% of the energy that was in the coal in the ground before it even gets to your house.
Mm-hmm. So some cogeneration is possible in certain urban environments, but in general, not an option.
Well, that actually is not correct. There is a lot of work in micro cogeneration or micro combined heat and power. Some of it's based on hydrogen. Some of it's based on natural gas. The Austrians have some wonderful devices that are based on micro cogen or micro CHP, based on wood pellet combustion and Stirling engines. There are solar powered Stirling engine micro CHP units being developed in Washington State, United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is that we need to move to a I believe we need to move to a universal combined heat and power strategy where every point of demand produces its own and does it in such a way that it utilizes the maximum amount of the energy in the fuel, both the heat and the electrical components.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And these strategies will vary, well, really by region of the country, right? So if you're in New England, it's going to be various kinds of biomass that will power this. If you're, someplace where hydro is possible, it'll be hydro. If you're someplace where there's a goodly supply of sun, it'll tend to favor solar, right?
Yes. In a word, there is no silver bullet, as they say. There's
right.
only silver buckshot.
Right. Right.
It's very interesting to look at the work on solar energy at MIT, where they found this way of directing it to the edges of windows and claiming astounding efficiencies, which may make it possible to use solar combined heat and power via hydrogen and fuel cells in the future sometime. But what is important to me, it seems, is that we develop a recognition of this end-to-end efficiency requirement, that we are willing to redesign our energy system to take into account everything we've learned in the last 200 years. And while a centralized plant looks, quote-unquote, convenient, it is thermodynamically not very sensible. Apparently, I'm not a thermodynamic expert, but what I'm reading suggests that that is the answer, but certainly not very efficient. We haven't had micro-combined heat and power. We still don't have micro-combined heat and power on a reliable, multi-vendor, industrial scale.
Mm-hmm.
But if we make that a national goal, I think that becomes quite real quite soon.
Yeah, the notion of a national goal is interesting because on the one hand, there are so many upsides to going in this direction, not only reducing dependence on oil and especially foreign oil, not only defusing the geopolitical nightmare that results from that dependence. But when you start to think about the kinds of new industries, the kinds of employment, the kinds of non-outsourceable jobs that will be produced, when we get back to making things, building things, installing things, retrofitting things, it seems like it's the absolute bright future for the economy is all of this stuff. But what actually I wonder about is that, back to this notion of kind of regional differences, the national policy wants to have an answer, right? And I don't think, we're looking at New England having a very different experience right now from the Southwest, from the Northwest, from the Midwest or the Southern Midwest and so on. And so how we articulate a national policy that's based on the principles that you've described, but sort of craft the incentives so that very different kinds of regional solutions come into play is, politically, I think a pretty interesting challenge. I don't know if there is precedent for that, or maybe it, of course there is, since we used to be a bunch of states, not a nation. So maybe that's another kind of going back to the roots process.
There's always this debate between the Jeffersonian model and the central banking model that raged in the early part of the country's history. And this distributed versus centralized model is a long and hoary political debate that has gone on for a very long time. Policy is always difficult, but policy that is informed by what I call a new world view that we must develop to replace the limits and the constraints, what I call the shackles of the Cold War worldview, can get us there. But if we stick with the limits of the Cold War worldview and its reliance on tit for tat and game theory, et cetera, and unfettered free market capitalism based solely on the single metric of profit or dollar value. We'll never get there.
Yep.
And one of the, not only is it economically stimulating to think of all the things that could happen if we adopted some other strategies that would create jobs that can't be exported, for example. I mean, you can't have someone in Bangalore fix my furnace.
Exactly.
Or install it, or make my grass tablet energy, or tabletize the cardboard at the transfer station so that the local school can be heated by the discarded fiber from local homes.
Or retrofit your house to make it, you know, 8 times more energy efficient.
Correct. Exactly. And what we people, one important factor to recognize is that one of the key arguments for relocalization is that every dollar that's kept in a community circulates more than once. So that if I make the fuel locally and use it locally, then all the money spent on that process is going to have a 2-to-1 economic acceleration factor.
Yep.
Whereas if I take that same money and give it to my local oil company, a tiny piece of that sticks locally and the rest of it leaves the state and probably the country.
Yep, yep.
So that it's an economic break rather than an economic stimulus.
Yep.
So that if our energy policy can promote a view where energy becomes an economic accelerant versus an economic break.
Exactly.
It's a day and night proposition.
Exactly.
Now to get back to tablets. I'm told it is a fairly well-known fact, and there's various research I could send you that suggests that the larger the form factor of the densified object, the cheaper it is to make, the simpler it is to make. For example, when you densify something, the rule of thumb is that the longest fiber should be no longer than the radius of what your form factor is. So if you're making a quarter-inch wood pellet, which is currently the standard domestic format, your longest fiber has to be, the radius is an eighth, right? So you have to grind your fibers down so the longest fiber is no longer than an eighth of an inch. And that's a lot of processing.
Mm-hmm.
If your input stock does not come to you already in pretty much that form factor, i.e. kiln-dried sawdust.
Right. Right.
Okay. So if you're a floor manufacturing company in the Middle South someplace, there's a bunch of them down there, you're making mountains and mountains of kiln-dried sawdust that is not real hard to pelletize.
Yeah, so that's what kick-started this whole industry, but that is obviously going to come to an end in the not-too-distant future, at which point it becomes about harvesting trees, which, as you say, is just a whole different equation.
In New England, once upon a time, we had a robust industry that produced a lot of sawdust. We had a lot of mills that made a lot of lumber, that made a lot of sawdust, you could make a lot of pellets. But the number of operating mills in New England is very small and declining.
Yeah, although they're probably going to come back into vogue, too. It all comes around.
Well, one would hope so. But when I was in high school, there was a farm at the school I went to, and we used to go down and get sawdust for the animal bedding. And it was not a problem. Today, getting animal bedding on a dairy farm is a big problem. Very expensive, very hard to find sawdust, trucked in from Canada and other places.
Right.
And people being forced to look at sand as a bedding material, even though that has a lot of wear and tear on your farm equipment. And adds no organic value, doesn't improve the tilth of the land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So
if we want to make, if we want to have a distributed fuel production system, we've got to have something that doesn't cost $14 million. That means we've got to have something that's easier to make, and this is just a larger form factor. And lo and behold, it turns out that there's this company in Pennsylvania and there's companies in Europe and other places that make densifying devices, tablet machines or whatever you want to call them, hockey, some people call them pucks, lots of different names.
Mm-hmm.
that require much less processing of the raw material. And in the case of grass, grass is a phenomenal solar collector, which is why it grows so well. But it also turns out if you process the grass or you farm the grass with an eye towards an energy crop rather than a nutrient crop, you cut it late in the year, but giving yourself enough time to let it get rained on once or twice to wash the minerals out, but still have the sun dry it down to 12 to 14%.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have solar growth. You're harvesting the waste fiber after the plant is through using it and has basically going into hibernation for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
That the sun has also dried down to a usable range. And then you can take this and chop it up and run it through a quarter-inch screen, so it's not a really big deal, and make tablets.
So the idea is this is more like a piece of farm equipment than it is like an industrial plant.
There you go. Just the way in dairy farming in Vermont, you can take hay and turn it into milk. You take grass and turn it into milk. That adds value to the grass.
Yeah.
But you can do a lot better if you take the milk and make cheese. Because the cheese-making process adds a great deal of value to the milk.
Mm-hmm.
And that increases what's called the farm gate income. Well, if you can take grass and turn it into fuel, you add a lot of value.
So what does this look like, right? I mean, if I'm a farmer, I'm going to have how many acres in grass? I'm going to have what size of machine? I'm going to have how many people, working the operation? What does it look like?
Well, I can only speculate because nobody's doing it yet,
uh-huh.
Not in this country at least.
Uh-huh.
But it looks like you have a capital investment in equipment somewhere between $100,000 and $150,000.
Okay.
Hopefully, we're going to be able to get it down to $20,000. But that's a few years out. And it makes much smaller quantities. But that for, let's say, $125,000, two men working 40 hours a week can produce enough fuel to service around 70 families in today's existing very inefficient homes where each family is going to burn 9 to 10 tons of fuel per year.
So that would come off of what kind of an acreage?
About 240 acres, producing 3 tons of dry matter. If you think you're going to produce half that much, it's 500 acres. If you're looking at a model where this community-supported energy is only really servicing families within a five-mile radius, if you do the math, five-mile radius has a lot of acres in it. In fact, 240 acres is about 0.4% of that land mass. So for, even if you only got a ton and a half of dry matter per acre, one of these small tableting plants would use 1% of the land in that five-mile radius.
Now, how does that compare to the harvest that you'd get if you were doing sustainable forestry on the same amount of land?
Well, I'd have to dig up the studies that the Biomass Energy Resource Center in Montpelier has done. Trees, there are numbers out there that show you get so many tons of new growth per year.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various studies that suggest how many tons we're taking out currently. And that gives you some sort of a net that we could take out above and beyond what we're currently taking out and still be sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with trees, as wonderful as trees are, is they typically take 20 years to produce, an economical amount of biomass.
Mm-hmm.
Grass takes 3 months. And it's not that one is better than the other, they're different. And that if we want both an open landscape, a mixed use, if we want a mixed use landscape, which in Vermont is certainly important, and I think in New Hampshire it's something that they would like to get back to.
Yeah.
Then we've got to be able to have economic benefit from both forest and field.
Mm-hmm. So the answer is we will have both side by side, both. I'm just going to just back of the envelope kind of guess here that some roughly equivalent acreage is sustainable using either source.
Well, I guess it gets to a very interesting question, actually, which is, in any given micro environment, weather, soil, geography, what's the appropriate balance between field and forest? And again, there is no one right answer. If you have very steep terrain, forest is the answer. If you have beautiful flat fields, fields may be the answer. And how you determine the useful ratio in any given micro environment is a very interesting question that most people, I don't think, is commonly asked. So one of the really interesting problems we're facing is the restoration of a solid fuel culture. I mean, our grandparents took burning coal for granted. Everybody went down to the basement twice a day and shook the coals and fed the furnace, and that was just what you did.
Yep.
And no one questioned it.
Yep.
It was normal. We lost all that when we were seduced by the convenience, the seemingly free convenience of seemingly cheap fossil fuel energy.
Yep.
We now understand that it came with a hell of a price tag. But the convenience was, quote-unquote, wonderful. I mean, you probably can remember, or you certainly heard of, the phrase, too cheap to meter.
Yep.
When technological hubris proposed that atomic power plants would produce electricity that you basically give away.
Yep.
Well, again, here is the problem with atomic power. Nobody insists on a full end-to-end life cycle accounting that includes every step of the way, and that's from zero to 400,000 years or longer. And if you really do honest accounting and don't cook the books a la Enron, you find out that the cost of building a plant is one thing, the cost of fueling is another, the cost of fuel storage is another, the cost of fuel disposition for 400,000 or 500,000 years is another. The cost of decommissioning is another. If you do an honest accounting, the electricity from an atomic power plant is too expensive to buy. Forget too cheap to meter. It's too expensive to buy. But people, we need to insist on a honest accounting that takes in the full life cycle end to end. All of the internet, sort of end-to-end principle.
Yeah, so to your question of convenience, then it is an interesting one. It might seem that, as you said, the return to a solid fuel discipline is something that everyone's going to be pretty much reluctantly dragged kicking and screaming back to. But on the pellet question, although relatively few people are using them in this way, there is an automated feed possibility with wood pellets. And I've seen a couple of installations of pellet silos, right, where a truck comes, dumps a year's worth of pellets in, and, you know, you really have the kind of set it and forget it thermostat experience.
Going back to coal, they did develop with peak coal automatic feeders and stokers and ash removal systems. That was at the end of the coal era. There were some very sophisticated solid fuel energy systems that were relatively convenient.
Yeah.
And today, we're looking at solid fuel combustion systems in Europe and in the United States, and getting better and better as we go forward, that are relatively automatic and relatively convenient. I'm working with a company, Montpelier, that has a what I call a pellet upgrade system that works with new and existing boilers, and you never use an oil gun, you put in a pellet gun, and it involves going down once a week to tap out some ashes, and every 3 or 4 tons you suck out some more ashes and brush down the tubes, but that's all you do. Otherwise it's all automatic, and if the fuel feed is automatic, and you know, you use your thermostat and set the thermostat just like you would your current heat system.
Right. So this is the automatic pellet delivery scheme that I was mentioning. So is it the case that these larger kind of, as you said, puck-shaped, puck-sized grass pellets are initially going to be more difficult to handle automatically in that way, but potentially could be, just like anything potentially could be?
Well, you have to understand that there are coal plants that automatically handle fairly big pieces of coal.
Mm-hmm.
It's utterly possible to auger 3-inch tablets.
Okay.
And we're talking about 1.5-inch tablets.
Okay.
So, yes, you know, handling an 1.5-inch densified biomass object, and I prefer to use densified biomass rather than grass, because it could be grass, it could be cardboard, it could be wood, it could be some mixture of all of the above.
Huh, okay.
There's no need that it has to be only wood or only grass or only cardboard.
Okay.
With experimentation, every locale is going to find a blend of fibers that works the best for them, given their local conditions.
Okay.
Which is quite liberating. It also means that the combustion equipment needs to be developed that's reasonably auto-sensing and auto-adjusting, and that we need to make sure that the combustion is complete and thorough and that we're not sticking nasty stuff out the stacks. Just because we can burn something doesn't mean that we can burn it any old which way. We have to be careful and use the appropriate combustion technologies. But that's, you know, that's just technology. That's not a big deal.
Yeah. Well, the pellet stoves appear to be doing, I mean, the current generation, the ones that I've seen, the one that I have, seem to be doing a very good job in that respect. I'm sure it could be better.
A pellet appliance?
Yeah.
A stove in your living room?
Yeah.
That's what we affectionately call a supplemental heater.
Right.
I have one, too.
Right.
They're fair. The problem is because they typically have glass windows that they talk about air washing to keep the soot off. They over-oxygenate the fire, and you really lose. You don't have tight control of the combustion process. They're aesthetically pleasing, but they're not, from a combustion point of view, optimal.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a fine point that I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over. But one of the challenges we have as we move towards houses that are zero net energy houses, that don't have furnaces in them, never will have furnaces in them, that have small combined heat and power, micro combined heat and power appliances in them, so that every home produces its own heat and cooling and electricity. And the electricity can even power the car, because most Americans only drive about 20 miles a day anyway. There's a bridge strategy of solid fuel to get us off of this fossil fuel is probably an important tool in the toolkit.
Right. So to be clear, so you have formed a company. The company is Pellet Futures. Is that right?
Well, yes. We actually formed three things recently. We formed something called the Grass Energy Collaborative in December of 2005, and that is now lives at the Biomass Energy Resource Center in Montpelier.
Okay.
As a happy home there. Then I formed a company called Biomass Commodities Corporation with a gentleman named Avril Cook as my partner. And that's going on quite well under Avril's leadership now. And I have subsequently this year formed a consulting business called Pellet Futures.
Okay.
In which I get my brain picked on a fairly regular basis by people who are trying to think about these issues. And I try to help people be successful with this transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy.
Okay, so you're working on a range of solid fuel biomass options. The grass tablets being part of that strategy, and the grass tablet project is in sort of an R&D phase, you would say, at this point.
Right. On September 20th at Shelburne Farms, they have their annual harvest festival. This year, September 20th, and we will be demonstrating the grass tabletizing machine from Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And we will be demonstrating my high school senior's stove, downdraft gasifying stove that burns pellets, green wood chips, and grass tablets. And if we're lucky, Mark Carlisle will have his grass tablet compatible combustion system here as well.
Okay, so in this model, it's a two chamber gasifier, and you'd be loading the grass tablet pellets into the top chamber for gasification.
That could be the way it was done. There are many ways of handling this. I like to draw a distinction between closely coupled combustion and gasification.
Okay.
And the distinction is this. If you gasify something and take the gases off to be used someplace else or to be used in a different device, such as an internal combustion engine, that we call gasification.
Okay.
If you burn a fuel in two stages, a primary and secondary, we would call that closely coupled combustion.
Okay. So this is what a so-called wood gasification boiler is doing.
What most of the devices we're doing now recognize that, you know, the first thing you do is you take the solid fuel and you basically turn it into a combustible gas.
Yes.
And you burn some of that in the first stage of combustion. And then in the second stage of combustion, which may or may not be in a separate chamber, you introduce secondary air to get complete combustion of all the gases.
Yes.
And you then typically get a flame temperature of several thousand degrees, 2,000 to 2,200 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And you get very clean combustion.
Mm-hmm.
You get no creosote. You get no chimney fires.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, compared to fuel oil, significantly lower sulfur emissions, so you have a big improvement on the acid rain picture.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have significant improvement in the particulate emissions of compared to fossil fuel.
Even compared to an oil burner?
Yep.
Really?
And I'm getting a study from New England Wood Pellet next week when Charlie comes back from vacation that was done in Maine that verifies this. And where solid fuel combustion has a downside, it's in the NOx department, because when you introduce, you have to introduce more air into the chamber to burn solid fuel than you do with a mist of fossil fuel.
Okay.
And when you, of course, air is full of nitrogen. So the more air you introduce into the combustion chamber, the more nitrogen you get out the stack.
Mm.
And in the high temperatures, nitrogen turns into NOx.
Mm.
So there will be an increase in NOx with solid fuel combustion, although that problem is being addressed pretty heavily by all the diesel manufacturers. And I'm sure that the solutions that they find with their deep pockets we can apply to burning solid fuels. Because NOx is NOx, whether it's coming out of a solid fuel combustion system or whether it's coming out of a diesel engine.
Okay. And then what you also get out of this is a radically reduced quantity of firewood for the same amount of, or quantity of biomass for the same amount of BTUs extracted, because you're getting all of them out, right?
Probably there isn't much of a combustion efficiency gain in America right now, because your typical oil furnace that's properly tuned is in the low 80% range.
Mm-hmm.
A properly run biomass combustion device is in the low 80% range.
Yeah, no, actually what I'm doing is comparing, let's say, a wood gasification boiler to a, you know, conventional wood stove or fireplace.
Yeah, there are many, many ways to burn biomass. And, you know, you start with a fireplace, and that's not terribly efficient. You can then have a conventional wood stove, and that's going to be moderately efficient. There's a big gain over a fireplace, and then you can have a pellet or a tablet combustion system that, because it's metering the fuel very carefully and very carefully controlling the combustion environment,
yeah,
you can get more predictably, more reliable efficiency than you can with a supplemental heater parlor stove.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right, right.
And there are European biomass boilers now that are in the 90% efficient range because they've taken Kyoto seriously. I mean, there are consequences for what you decide to do. And because the Europeans embrace Kyoto, they embraced solid fuel a lot earlier. And when they embraced solid fuel a lot earlier, they're way ahead of us in the technologies for wringing the value out of the solid fuel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I imported a few months ago an eco wood gasification boiler from Northern Europe.
Yes, they're good, efficient boilers you can get in the United States now, but right now most of the people are importing. I mean, that's a great opportunity. Why isn't there a North Country combustion technology company producing state-of-the-art solid fuel combustion devices?
Well, there will be within 3 years. There has to be.
I would certainly hope so. I mean, you would think the Europeans would license us their technology, but they seem to be able to sell everything they can make in Europe without having to bother with America, so why bother?
Right.
But it's a great opportunity for American ingenuity to create wonderful, very highly efficient, optimized solid fuel systems.
Yeah, back to my point, this is getting back to things that we used to be good at. and we will, I think, be good at again. And we're going to, among other things, just feel an awful lot better about ourselves when we finally come to grips with some of this stuff and realize that our, kind of latent engineering and mechanical prowess, it hasn't gone away. It's not all about the internet and information systems and, that kind of high technology. There's a whole area of high technology having to do with these basic energy processes that, we haven't exercised those muscles in a long time.
Correct.
That's the end of part one. In part two, next week, we discuss zero energy houses, micro-combined heat and power, and the Electronet, a smarter version of today's electric grid that would serve as a battery backup and as an exchange for locally produced power.
You've been listening to Interviews with Innovators with host John Udell.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was John Udell. Our website editor was Niels Makel. The series producer is Niels Makel.
This is Phil Wendley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great edition of Interviews with Innovators on IT Conversations.